You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
You can hear me that? Yes. No mai, hara mai, ki te wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday. Te rā rua te kaumātahi o Whiringa a Nuku, the 21st of October. My name is Bronnie and I'll be with you for the next hour. If I can they coming up on the show today, we've got Dear Science with Marcus Jones live in studio today, talking about the first ever room temperature superconductor, a new NASA mission which aims to fist bump asteroids, and the mystery of why adding salt to sweet foods makes them taste even sweeter. Felix speaks to Annie Newman from Air 2 Union about the election results and what this means for workers' rights. And I interviewed Brooke Van Velden, deputy leader of the ACT Party, about her party's success and what this means going forward. We've then got some clips from New Zealand First Tracy Martin speaking about what's next for her and her response to Barry Soper's theory about the party's unsuccessful election result. Ka we ware ware e āhei ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakehere rokiroki marunga te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho. Me haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 Waia Mai Rānei or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Let's not mess around though, let's get into some science.
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes, kia ora. Kia ora MOTAT and kia ora Marcus, how are you doing this morning?
I'm pretty good, how are you?
Good, glad to be back.
Nice to be face to face in the studio for a change.
Yeah, and got some exciting stories ahead. So I'm interested to know about this superconductor, which is at room temperature, which is apparently something quite exciting, because I guess, to begin with, what are superconductors and what temperature are they normally, if not room temperature?
So, superconductors are materials that are able to conduct electricity with zero resistance. In other words, there is no energy loss as the charge moves through the material. And these are very, very important materials for a whole wide range of applications, but not in the least, transmitting energy down long wires. You know, a lot of that energy is lost, and superconductors that would drop down to zero. Also applications in maglev trains and all sorts of other things, exciting things. But so this is a really, really exciting finding, because most materials actually become superconducting when you take them down to really, really, really low temperatures, so
right,
a few degrees above absolute zero. And there have been attempts for a long time now to try and find materials that are superconducting at room temperature, because if it's at room temperature, then you have to pay lots of money to keep them cool and refrigerate and things like that. So there are some very well-known materials that are superconducting above liquid nitrogen temperatures, and that's significant, but liquid nitrogen is fairly cheap to produce. There's a lot of nitrogen around in the air, and so we can use, so there are some applications for superconducting materials that are superconducting at those temperatures, but that's still about minus 140 degrees or so.
Oh.
Which is cold.
yeah,
which is pretty cold. So it's been a lot of people have been working on trying to find materials that are superconducting at around room temperature, and they've found a material. It's not very well understood and it's not very well characterized yet, but it's found that they were able to see superconducting behavior at temperatures up to about 15 degrees C. So that's plus 15 degrees C. There's a slight wrinkle in that, yes, it is superconducting at 15, but it only is superconducting at extremely high pressures. So
right,
pressures more like the center of this planet, the center of the core of the Earth. So incredibly high pressures, at regular atmospheric pressure, it would certainly not be superconducting. But it's a step in the right direction, and it opens up a new avenue of research. And it's interesting because, about 2 years ago, and I think we talked about it on the show, but about 2 years ago, they discovered a type of superconducting material that was superconducting at around about minus 10, minus 20 or something like that degrees C. But that was only composed of two elements, lanthanum and hydrogen. Mm. This material comprises three elements rather than two, carbon, sulfur, and hydrogen. And the fact that it's got three elements greatly broadens the amount of sort of the combinations that can be included in future experiments. So there's more ways to sort of tweak the material now. So it's possible that they can start bringing that pressure down.
Because needless to say, keeping something at very low temperatures would be expensive. It seems like keeping things at very high pressure would probably be more expensive.
Yeah, well, physically sort of impractical. I mean, we're talking 2.6 million times the atmospheric pressure at sea level. So,
right.
it's not feasible, but it's a step in the right direction.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, then to move on to the second topic, and it's interesting the way they've decided to phrase this article, NASA's fist-bumping asteroids. I mean, it's an interesting way to put it. What's the actual purpose of this mission? It's not just to go out there and give them a, hey, bro, what's up?
Well, it's not, obviously, but it's what they're actually doing is more of, instead of landing on an asteroid and digging around, so like they've got rovers roving around Mars and things, this is a body of rock that's been floating around space potentially since soon after the dawn of the solar system. And there's a lot of interest in what happened when the solar system started forming and what bodies were around, what was the chemistry, the geochemistry that occurred in those early days of the solar system. And so they think this rock could give a lot of clues to what was going on in those early days, because they think it's basically been floating around space for billions and billions of years. It's not very big, and this is sort of the key problem. You have rovers roving around Mars. It's like a planet. It's got decent amount of gravity. This rock is about the size of the Empire State Building in New York, so it's a relatively small body of rock.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you were standing on it, you know, you really wouldn't be very well connected. If you pushed up a little bit, you would float off into space. The gravitational field is very, very weak.
Right, hence the fist bumping. It's more.
Hence the fist. So what they've got, this is OSIRIS-REx probe launched in 2016. And it's following a couple of missions from the Japanese space agency that have gone to different asteroids and collected, you know, tiny amounts of dust from the asteroids and the process of bringing that back to Earth. But this mission, it actually lowers down. So it's currently sort of in the vicinity of the asteroid, and it's going to lower down very, very slowly to the surface. But just a small distance away from the surface, and it's going to expel sort of a puff of nitrogen, which will kick up a cloud of dust and debris, which hopefully it will collect. Mm. They're looking to get about 50 grams or so of material. If it doesn't do it the first time, it'll lower itself back down, try it again, and try and get enough material, and then go away. So it doesn't actually touch down or sort of rove around or anything like that.
Yeah.
And the slight wrinkle was, this is, you know, they did try to do Earth observations of this thing, but it's a long way away, and they couldn't really see the surface very clearly or at all, really. So they thought, they'd hoped it would be fairly smooth. It certainly isn't. There's lots of big boulders and things, sort of, it's very, very rough surface. And so they didn't really, when they got there, they were a bit worried, because they didn't. It was going to be difficult to lower down to the surface when there was lots of boulders and rocks around.
Mm.
But they found this fairly small, just a few square meter sort of patch of a crater that is relatively smooth. And it was like sort of going down, between skyscrapers almost, down into this little crater, and then lowering it and then raising itself back up again. So they've had to work a lot on doing this automatically, because the probe is a long, long, long way from Earth. They can't. The time it takes for the signals to get from the probe to Earth mean that they can't control it directly. So it's all has to be autonomously controlled. And so this is going to be happening in the next few weeks, I think. And the going into this sort of 60-meter wide crater, and hopefully bring back some materials in about 2 years, 2 or 3 years from now.
Right,
once it finally makes its way back to Earth. And so this will be actually the biggest sample return. And it's only about 50, 60 grams, but it's the biggest sample return since Apollo.
Wow.
But potentially, if it works.
Yeah.
And then they'll be able to take that material, study its chemistry, understand a little bit more, a lot more about how the solar system was formed.
Very exciting. Oh, we'll have another episode of Dear Science in 2 years' time when they get those results back.
Yes.
And now, so to move to this last story, a bit of a fun one that we were going to touch on the other week, but we were busy talking about Nobel Prizes, salt and how it makes fruit and lollies sweet. Now, I'm sure this is something that many people are already aware of, but this is kind of the first time they've been able to prove why that's the case.
Yeah, so first of all, I think this story is worthy of a Nobel Prize, but most people know that if you have salted caramel, it tastes a little bit sweeter. It tastes a bit better than just sugary material by itself. So sweet food gets sweeter when you add a little bit of salt. And it wasn't really understood quite why this was the reason for this, because scientists knew that there was this family of receptors in your taste buds called T1R, which pick up natural sugars and artificial sweeteners, and you pick up that sweet sense. And originally, about 15 years ago, scientists thought that disabling that receptor would stop any response to the sweetness, so you wouldn't be able to detect sweet things anymore. But it turns out that mice can, and they've shown that they can, and they found a different mechanism for detecting the sweetness, and this is something called a co-transporter, sodium glucose co-transporter, so SGLT1, I think it's labeled, and this co-transport, this mechanism uses sodium, as in sodium from salt, to carry glucose into cells and then sort of give the cells energy. And this protein is found in these sweet responsive taste cells. So it was found that in the experiments with mice that even with the original receptor turned off, the mice were able to, that they could detect a physical response in the mice that responded to a sweet response when they used sodium salt with sweet foods, and they connected it with this protein that carries both materials into cells.
And so they concluded there's actually three types of sweet sensitive taste cells.
Yes, and it's, so the two types I've talked about, and the final type employs both pathways, and it also responds to fatty acids and umami flavors. And the researchers propose that these provide a way to detect very calorie-rich foods. So this sort of taste spectrum is getting broader and more complex as with research.
And interestingly, it didn't do the same for artificial sweeteners. Was that the case?
No, and I think this second pathway is glucose specific, so it's more specific for natural sugars rather than artificial sugars.
That's very interesting then. All right. Well, thank you very much, Marcus. We'd better let you go and get to class. But it's been great to have you here back in the studio, and we'll see you again in a fortnight's time.
Great. See you then.
And for everyone who's listening in, stay tuned after this. We'll be back with more.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
The best of all possible islands, Drive Island, is lost no longer.
Hey!
Cruise down and relax with your hosts, Johnny and Big Hungry, for a live drive extravaganza featuring deep conversation, heady yarns, free coffee thanks to Espresso Workshop, and of course, the star of the show, live music from Vanessa Worm and Draw. 95 BFM Drive Island, live from Alan Melville Centre, just off High Street. Friday, October 30, 4 to 7pm. Totally free and all ages, thanks to NZ On Air Music.
A lot of so-called kombucha is made from concentrate. That means it's tap water, flavour and non-nutritive sweetener, mixed up with some sour kombucha vinegar base. Doesn't exactly scream ancient health tonic, does it? Good Buzz is different. They're one of the only brands on the market to make authentically true brew kombucha that's never diluted, just fermented, then bottled, so it's good, naturally. Reach for the real deal. Reach for a Good Buzz. Real good booch, brewed and bottled in Tauranga.
Gang of Four.
Gang of Four.
Every Friday night, BFM's got you covered for the best tunes to preload to. With a revolving cast of BFM's favourite long-serving selectors, it's the Gang of Four. With Renee Jones, Pat Five, Phil Armstrong and The Professor. Gang of Four. Friday, 7 to 9pm on 95 BFM.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Following up on last week's election, Felix spoke to Annie Newman from the Eiretu Union about what the results mean for the future of workers' rights in Aotearoa.
Broadly speaking, is this new government an improvement for workers' rights compared to the previous one?
Yes, it definitely is an improvement for workers' rights. So the new government is, as we all know, is effectively, or the mandate has been given to Labor to govern alone. But, of course, the Greens have increased their vote, and that's great for workers as well. But it means that what has been commonly called the handbrake of New Zealand First is no longer on the government. And that was a problem for workers.
So in what ways did NZ First prevent workers' rights laws or policies?
They were very clear that they did not, that they supported fair pay agreements or industry standards in only a very limited context. So yes, they supported them for security guards, and that was one group that really raised the profile of industry agreements in the last term of government. But when it came down to it, they weren't prepared to see industry agreements as something that would apply across the board in New Zealand. And what we know is that workers who are in very atomised workplaces, who are often vulnerable and low paid, it cannot benefit in an individualised employment relationship environment. And so that move to fair pay agreements was fundamental to lifting the bottom up, and that's what New Zealand First was not prepared to back. And that was why, that's just one example, but they were not a pro-union party. They were a party that supported, I guess, the basic standards, statutory rights for workers, like the minimum wage increasing, but they didn't support increasing the power of workers' voice to negotiate their own pathway.
Yeah, so that fair pay that fair pay agreements thing, that was a policy that Labour introduced a bit more recently, and that was the result of a petition. And does the fact that they...
No, that's not quite right. Sorry. The fair pay agreements have been a Labour Party policy prior to the last election.
Right.
So that wasn't the product of a petition. That was the product of hard work by Labour affiliates in the union movement. Of unions in general looking to see how we could create a better platform or minimum for workers across the board. So that's been many years of work to create, and during the last term there was a working party that was established, and that was led by the former Prime Minister Jim Bolger, right? But it was tripartite, so it had workers, employers, and government representatives on it. They came out with a report that we endorsed as being the right way forward. However, that report, when it went into the government MBE, the Department for Workplace Relations, to be constructed into something that would lead to legislation, was modified basically with the input of New Zealand First. We support the original Working Party report that came out, and that's what we want to look forward to moving on as soon as there's a new government constructed.
Right. So my understanding was that this petition earlier in the year, a few months ago, I think, was calling for this, agreement with the security staff at COVID hotels to be expanded to other staff. But are you saying that
there's many things within a particular campaign? So the bigger campaign for fair pay agreements has been in place for a very long time. There are many sub campaigns that operate, or campaigns in their own right that operate to try to raise the wages of those who are low paid, like security guards. So really important for security guards. And we've had all sorts of petitions around different workers at Victoria University of Wellington and many different places. So they are all part of the activism that is happening around that space of how do we lift workers out of poverty.
Right. Well, thank you so much for clarifying that, because I think that's probably an area that has been kind of confusing for a lot of people. One of Labor's other policies is this plan to expand their FlexiWage scheme. I just wanted to ask you about FlexiWage. Has that been a successful idea thus far?
You're talking about subsidies. Oh, look, I think that there are kind of multiple different ways that you can do things, and they're not necessarily wrong, but what we have to be very aware of is as we go through a recovery period, we're in quite an exceptional time, and wage subsidies was one model that you'd never want to continue on into the future, because government shouldn't be running business for them. But it's a mechanism for keeping money flowing through the economy. So I think that as we're going to see a lot of different options probably on the table as we move through this recovery period. But ultimately, employers need to pay for the price of labour, and labour should be paid for at a price at which workers can survive and participate in society. So those two things are essential. So the living wage is important, because that's actually about making sure that workers earn enough money to survive and participate. Why else would you go out to work? You go out because you are earning a living to look after yourself and your family and, you know, live a life that's half decent. And so, it's really important that government don't become the subsidisers of employers to create decent lives for workers. But, of course, that exists in multiple different ways, you know, with tax credits and, you know, accommodation supplements, and all of those things are, in the end, a form of subsidy.
Mm. So earlier you commented on the fact that NZ First being out of parliament was a benefit to workers' rights. But I also want to talk about how the ACT Party has had a massive surge in support this time around. What sort of influence do you think the ACT Party will have on workers' rights over the next few years?
None, because they don't have any power.
Right, okay.
And it's important, you know, and it's important that we understand that this massive mandate has been given to the Labor Party, and an increased mandate for Greens and an increased mandate for ACT, but the people who actually hold the power of the Labor Party. So ACT won't have any influence on workers' rights over the next few years. What is frightening is the potential for them to have influence beyond that period. You know, when the dial switches back and we find democracy delivers to the right, we don't want ACT to have a high degree of control. That would be a very dangerous thing, because they don't even believe in workers. They would be taking New Zealand back to the period of the Employment Contracts Act, where relationships are contractual between an employer and an employee. And, you know, you might be able to go out and get yourself a lawyer or representative, but unions don't exist. Well, that was a very sad period in New Zealand's history, and that's what ACT would deliver for us.
Right, yeah, that's a good point, that while ACT might not necessarily have a whole lot of influence this time around, it does signal a sort of shift towards supporting ACT, the fact that they've shot up so massively. Yeah.
Oh, what we hope is that, you know, a lot of people have been voting for ACT who are traditional conservatives, and they don't like National. And there's a big difference between neoliberalism and conservatism. And you might see... them flick back to National if National gets its act together and looks like a functioning party.
So another thing that I want to ask about is benefits, because Labor isn't proposing any major changes, but they do want to do things like expand eligibility and that sort of thing, while Green is proposing a guaranteed minimum income. So what do you think about how these parties are addressing the benefit in terms of helping unemployment?
Well, the benefit needs to be addressed because actually it's a humanitarian issue that people who don't have work are not receiving enough money to live, and that's unacceptable in a Western nation. You know, we have to have people who are able to function and participate in society in numerous different ways, and that ultimately is a public benefit. So that my view is that part of the whole package of individuals, their families and their communities is how we serve those who are not fortunate enough to have a job for whatever reason, and also ensure that where they are able and willing to take on a job, they are well placed to do that. But if people live in desperate poverty and are not given other support, then they are never going to be in a place where they can take on other work. So I think that supporting, recognising people are individuals in society, and therefore, you know, they should be paid as individuals, whether they're in work or out work, is critical. And I think that Labor will take some steps. We, in all of these things, you have to push to get anything, and it's going to be the same for workers. You can never guarantee that the policies that you believe in or that you think align with a particular party policy is going to end up being legislation. You know, my view is that in democracy you just have to fight and fight and fight and you never give up.
Yes, I guess sort of going on the topic of this more, with Labor taking so many seats in Parliament, being able to govern alone, is there any concern that should they choose to govern alone, that Green might not have enough influence to implement these larger changes, like the changes that they want to make to the benefit?
Well, we don't know until the Prime Minister announces what her cabinet will be, exactly who will be in cabinet and what they might do with supporters such as the Greens, and whether or not they provide them with any role in government. But right now, you would have to say that they don't need to give them a role. And so the chance. So if Labor decides, well, you know, they gave us a mandate, so we're going to go for it, then Greens won't have a say. I'm not sure. Jacinda has kind of shown herself to be a bit of a consensus builder over the last 3 years, so it might be that she looks for ways that she works with them without having them at the cabinet table, but we won't know that probably in, I don't know, did you say end of next week or something?
Earlier you also said that you feel as though democracy is this thing that you keep fighting and you keep pushing for more. So what will you be pushing for over the next few years? Well, what are some areas where these parties have ignored workers' rights?
Well, I think there are a whole lot of areas, but fair pay agreements is a game changer. So the idea of establishing industry standards, where if you're a security guard or a cleaner or you work in a restaurant, you don't have to go and individually negotiate enough to be able to put bread on the table. That, in fact, that is covered off by an industry agreement where you take wages out of competition and businesses are not driving always to the lowest point possible by slashing the wage budget. That is a game changer for New Zealand. So that is the one that we will be really fighting for. But we will also be fighting for the living wage to make sure that the commitment that all the parties gave, Māori Party, Labour, Greens, New Zealand First, they all gave a commitment to move contracted workers across the state sector, that includes places like schools, to no less than the living wage is absolutely fundamental to the bottom up, because the minimum wage is not enough for a decent life.
That was Annie Newman from Air 2 speaking to Felix Walton. We'll be right back after this. Here's a song, Nuts, by Ian Isaiah.
This fake if that was you, don't water. Life too short to live the same day twice again tomorrow. Make new memories and date the old ones can't affect ya. Nobody is perfect, baby. We all deserve better.
Part-time service, no full-time success. If you know you're worth it, then treat you the best. Easy problem solving, got you ready for the
you
test.
You gotta make some room. You gotta make some room.
For people that wanna love,
it's about to hit. Patience running thin.
And it is odd for somebody to pay you $100 for a photo of your feet. That is not normal behaviour.
The Wire.
After winning around 8% of the votes over the weekend, the ACT Party is set to bring 10 MPs into Parliament, the most in the party's history. In 1999, the party won 9 seats, but in recent history, it has been a one-person party. I spoke to Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden about the ACT Party's success and what is next for her as an MP. I started by asking her what she thought contributed to this unprecedented victory.
This is a really exciting time for the ACT Party. I mean, we've grown from one MP now to 10 MPs. And I think really what it is that throughout the Epidemic Response Committee in particular, so many people were wanting someone in Parliament to stand up and ask the government hard questions and hold them to account on what the government was actually doing for an economic recovery and for a health response to COVID-19. And David Seymour was that person, and I think the questions that he was asking resonated across the country, which is why we've seen a surge in our support. But not only that, throughout the last 3 years in the last parliamentary term, we had the ACT Party standing up on a position of principle on the End of Life Choice Act. You know, David Seymour actually turned down a ministerial position on a basis of principle to keep passing the End of Life Choice Act. And I think a lot of people see the courage that that takes and also the conviction and genuine need to have honest conversations about policy that would make New Zealand a better place. And not only did he stand up on his principles for an issue that so many New Zealanders care about, he also stood against 119 other people when it came to issues that other New Zealanders cared about too. And I think throughout that whole three-year cycle, just being genuine and steadfast and standing up for your values and values that New Zealanders care about, I think has made the shift for the ACT Party.
I guess what's going to be really interesting about this is how do you feel about being part of a party that has for so long been a one-man show with David Seymour, and how are you going to adapt this to being more of a team front?
Oh, look, it's a really exciting opportunity, and I think one of the things I'm really looking forward to is actually when we get back into a real parliamentary environment and starting to debate the ideas, because I've met all of our top 10 candidates, or now MPs, over these last couple of months, and I really, really am excited to get to work with them. And we all came down yesterday to Parliament, and it was such a positive environment. And, you know, we've got in our top 10 7 small business owners. So they'll be bringing those genuine questions from the small business community to Parliament about what is this government going to be doing for the next 3 years in terms of legislation that might actually cause more costs for small businesses. But not only that, we've just got such a diverse range of people. We've got, for example, number eight, who's a farmer from Northland, giving that real genuine rural spokesperson role to Parliament that we haven't seen for quite a while. So I think we've got a real range of talent. And most importantly, although we've got all of our different individual backgrounds and skills, we're all bound together by that sense of personal responsibility and the values that underpin the ACT Party. So no matter what subject that we'll be debating in the next 3 years, we're all going to be bound by that collective responsibility.
Yeah, and that is something that former United Future leader Peter Dunn has issued like a friendly warning to new MPs. He says that the biggest surprise will be kind of realising that it's not necessarily these individual talents that MPs are prized for, but for having to just, you know, represent the team brand. How do you feel like that transition is going to be?
Oh, look, I think that's going to be quite straightforward, really, because ultimately every issue that the ACT Party will be putting up or debating in Parliament this term will be, why has New Zealanders voted for us to be here? So I think it's really important to kind of always reflect on the people that put you in this position to begin with. And one of those really strong points is making sure that we're going back out into the community and talking to the people that voted for ACT in the first place. And so one of the first things that we're going to be doing over the next 4 weeks is actually doing a thank you tour and going back out into the community and saying, thank you so much for your support. How do you want us to represent you?
Well, on that topic of that team approach and that group mentality, I just wondered, is that somehow kind of at odds with the individualistic libertarian ethos?
I can see how you're coming to that. No, I don't think so. So all of us, although we've got our individual backgrounds and areas that we really care about, are all bound together by a sense that the government should be limited and that we should be putting in place laws that actually make New Zealand a better place for everyone instead of taking away people's rights. So there's always fundamental principles that we can collectively come back on.
I know there's been a lot of talk and a lot of theorising about where these voters came from. A lot of people saying they're coming from previous National or New Zealand First. Do you have any kind of take on that?
Yeah, I think people are coming from all areas of society. I saw a poll that came out a few weeks ago and it said 10% of our new voters had come over from the Māori Party. And I suggest that that's probably a sense of tēnā ranga tiritanga, of that self-determination, which is also, you know, aligned with the ACT Party's values, but also on the issue that our party has been campaigning for a really long time, which is the issues of charter schools, which had a huge impact on Māori kids' lives. And so I think there is an alignment between our parties there. There's been some people that have come over from the Labour Party, and I think that's specific to, you know, the areas of free speech, but also actually wanting to have honest conversations about things that Labour in the last term said that they wanted to do but never did, things like housing reform and things like transforming the mental health sector. So those are areas where ACT has had some really honest conversations, and I think people genuinely want us to progress those ideas.
I think it is safe to say, though, that probably a large number did come from the already sort of right camps of National. And I was wondering, how much do you think National's poor performance this electoral cycle played into it? You know, do you think it was a case of people voting for ACT, or were they just not voting for National?
No, I think people were voting for ACT, because the thing here is that nobody owns votes. You know, every person in New Zealand has the same, you know, one vote per person, and they can choose where to send that vote. So no party owns a vote. And if a person wants to support a party and their principles or their what they're going to progress over the next few years, I think that is a genuine vote for a party versus a vote against. But certainly I think the fundamental problem that National had in the last couple of months definitely didn't help, was and kind of their leaks and the members who left. So I think we have been a sense of stability, but also being very clear about what our focus is going to be.
Just lastly, I guess, what is ACT going to do in the next 3 years to ensure that this remarkable result isn't a one-off and that it does carry on into the next election?
Oh, well, we'll be making sure to always go back to why have the people given us this support and not taking that for granted. You know, the worst thing to happen would be for people to say that they're going to do one thing and then completely do the opposite once they're in power. So it's very apparent to us that not only do we need to be a party of opposition and holding whoever forms this next government to account, whether that's Labor and the Greens as a formal coalition or just Labor by themselves, but also putting forward proposition. So we need to be making sure that we're not only asking the hard questions, but giving a real solution as an alternative. And so I think if we get that right, then not only can we maintain our support, but I think we can grow it.
That was Brooke Van Velden, Deputy Leader of the ACT Party. We'll be right back after this. I've just got a song. It's Medicine Man by Scratch 22.
Everything is brighter at Night Lights by MOTAT. Enjoy incredible light-based art installations by NZ artists, illuminating live performances, food trucks, and more. Night Lights at MOTAT. Labor weekend, October 23rd to 25th. Get your tickets now at motat.nz.
Ooh.
Ah.
Fantastical.
Plato's Retreat is a show like no other. Clean, safe, and discreet. Perfect for the free-thinking modern adult. Meet your hosts, Sam, Chris, Jen, and Rob, and leave your jacket and your inhibitions at the door. Plato's Retreat on 95 BFM. 4 to 7 p.m. every Saturday, thanks to Castles Brewing Co.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Welcome back. Now, after receiving only 2.7% of the votes and no electorate seats this election, New Zealand First will not be returning to Parliament. This has only happened once before in the party's history, in 2008, where they also fell short of the 5% threshold. This result also means the end of my weekly chats with Tracy Martin. We respect and understand her choice not to speak to the media at this time as she figures out the changes and carries on with the last of her ministerial responsibilities. However, we were able to draw some clips from her Facebook page where she discussed the election results and what this means moving forward. She began by noting this is not the first time New Zealand First has been ousted from Parliament.
In 2008, New Zealand First was not returned to Parliament, certainly for very different reasons and certainly with some very different numbers. But we've been here before, so, you know, some, I'm sure, are in a bit of shock. Some in the party are obviously, you know, sort of affected by the loss. But to be frank, we've been here before. So life goes on. People got to get up and keep moving. That's how the world works. And we're no different. So that's what I'm going to do.
Martin then spoke about what's next for her.
So New Zealand First has not been returned to Parliament. So that means that, like my fellow colleagues, I am out of a job, which is okay because there's lots of other people that are out of a job, all right? So we're no special, no more special than anybody else. Right at this moment in time, though, I am still a caretaker minister. So obviously you can hear in the news that the Prime Minister is moving quite quickly with the mandate that she has from the New Zealand public to form a government. What that means is that, you know, within the next 3 weeks, possibly, she'll be able to go to the Governor-General and actually hold a ceremony to swear in all the new ministers. And once that happens, then obviously I'm no longer a minister and I'm no longer an MP. But during this period of time, I'm a caretaker minister. And that means if there are minor issues, because you can't deal with anything major while you're a caretaker, if there are minor issues that need to be signed off, if there are minor issues that need decisions that aren't a change of policy of you know, the current government, then I need to take care of those because that's still my job right at this moment in time.
A second of Tracy Martin's videos dealt with the recent commentary by Barry Soper. On Monday, RNZ spoke with Newstalk ZB political editor Barry Soper about why New Zealand First had fallen short of Parliament this election. Soper attributed the drop in support to a feeling of betrayal amongst supporters, dating back to the previous election in 2017. Soper claims the decision to go with Labour over National 3 years ago is one that cost Winston Peters his spot in Parliament this past weekend.
I think his supporters were so disappointed after the last election. Here he went with a party that had about 10% less than the National Party, and his supporters, I suspect, would have expected him to go with National. He decided he, in his infinite wisdom, would go with Labour. And there's only one reason he did that. He can't stand Bill English, and neither could he stand Paula Bennett. So there was nowhere in the world he was going to go with National. And he anointed Jacinda Ardern as the Prime Minister. I would love to know, and of course he'd never tell you, does he rue the day now, given his criticism of Labour and the lack of experience? Well, he chose them, so he had to live with them.
Tracy Martin disagreed with Soper's theory.
The first thing that Barry said was that he felt that the undoing of Winston Peters happened 3 years ago because his supporters would have been incredibly disappointed that he went with Labour, not National. Now, some of New Zealand First supporters were disappointed. Absolutely. I can think of the Waikato, for example, and a pretty extreme response that our poor candidate, who's a great guy, Stu Husband in the Waikato, got from his committee. But Winston Peters didn't pick Labour. New Zealand First did. So there's still this myth that Winston is a dictator. And certainly he has been the leader of New Zealand First. And when you take on the burden of being leader, you get a certain level of, you know, a certain level of leeway, a certain level of sort of special treatment. So you lead, and that is the way it goes. But New Zealand First chose the Labour Party, and it was chosen on policy. It was chosen on exactly what Winston said in his speech that night, which was to change the direction of the country.
She notes that in some policy areas, New Zealand First actually aligned more with Labour than they did with National.
I mean, I took 600 pages of policy into those negotiations, both with Labour and with National. And let's just take education, for example. There were 54 points of commonality in our education policy between Labour and New Zealand First. That meant there were 54 things that we agreed needed to be done, that Labour agreed needed to be done, that we didn't need to put in a coalition agreement because we both agreed that it was going to get done. And Chris Hipkins and I have gone on and put into place and either started or have delivered many of those things over the last three-year period. When it came to the National Party, New Zealand First has a policy which is the upfront investment policy. New Zealand First has believed that tertiary education should not create a debt on students way back from when Brian Donnelly was the New Zealand First spokesperson for education. I didn't invent it. Brian Donnelly did. And so we have stood for that. One of the conversations we had with the National Party, that we just have a major point of difference, is they do not believe that our young people should be able to get their tertiary education without it bringing them into debt. They just don't agree with that. So there wasn't a lot of conversation in that education space.
On the topic of Winston Peters criticising Labour for their lack of experience, Martin was quick to admit that there was an experience on all sides of the coalition agreement.
We knew there was an experience there. There was an experience here too, let's be clear. I had never been a minister before either. So, yes, there were moments of inexperience inside the current government. I tell you what, when the government changes again, if you have a look at the National Party benches, and let's say in two terms or whatever, the government changes again, the same thing will be true.
But she disagrees that Winston Peters' comments about inexperience were indicative of the entire three-year relationship between the parties.
Winston gave that comment at a time when there were things going on that he was frustrated by, I'm sure. But to be perfectly frank, that comment does not reflect the whole 3 years of this government. And it certainly doesn't reflect the relationship that I have seen between the Right Honourable Winston Peters and Jacinda Ardern. He admires many of her traits, and I know that she admires many of his. So I'm sorry, Barry, but you're not right there. I don't believe you're right there. I don't think it's as simple as that.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire. That was The Wire.
Oh, and that sting just summed up exactly what I said that was. Koira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of our show for another week. Nei te mihi ki a koutou I kōrero mai ki a māua mō tēnei rā. Big thanks to those of you who spoke to us for the show today. We had Marcus Jones, Annie Newman, Brooke Van Velden and Tracy Martin for letting us use those clips. And thank you to Felix also for his fantastic work over the weekend in our election coverage. He had some very spicy hot takes, which I hope you enjoyed. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thank you to all of you who tuned in. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. We'll be back next week. We've been having lots of texts throughout the day about the election coverage, and I'm glad to hear that you guys enjoyed it, because we certainly did here. I'm now going to leave you with a song I felt was appropriate to play on the night, but I didn't quite have time. Here's Listen to Us by Homebrew, feat Tourette's, and up next is Bridge with The Wonder Four. Kei te whakarongo koe, ki te rangi poho. You're listening to 95 BFN.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.